This week, Does Not Compute is brought to you by Rollbar. Rollbar makes it really simple to find and fix production errors. Instead of relying on user-reported issues, sifting through tons of log files trying to diagnose an issue, or getting overloaded with dozens or hundreds of email alerts for every exception, Rollbar automatically lets you know when something has gone wrong. You can get a Slack message, an email, or even turn errors into issues in Jira, Pivotal Tracker, or Trello. Rollbar also lets you easily link errors to source code hosted in GitHub, Bitbucket, or GitLab. Rollbar works with all major languages and frameworks, and you can be up and running tracking production errors in just minutes. Great companies like Twilio, Twitch, Zendesk, Kayak, and Heroku trust Rollbar to give them the context they need to quickly find and fix bugs. They've got a special offer for Does Not Compute listeners. If you go to rollbar.com/DNC and sign up, they'll give you 1 month of their Bootstrap plan for free. Our thanks to Rollbar for sponsoring the show, and remember to visit rollbar.com/DNC to learn more and sign up. So we're going to start off with the Go thing.
Go get.
We don't do bits on this show.
It's kind of cute though, right? Go get package name. It's like, ha, that's hilarious. That's what I thought to myself when I first saw it.
Also, the mascot is a gopher.
Yeah, it's cute. Cutie. Anyhow.
Almost too cute.
Yeah. Been looking at Go, trying to read some documentation. It looks very foreign to me still.
Yeah, I've written a little bit of stuff in Go when I was at Imagix, not anything all that interesting, and I probably messed up a bunch of idioms, but it was all right. It was interesting. Go is, I feel like Go is just one of those tools for me where I look at it and it's kind of like, yeah, this looks really cool and people are making a lot of neat stuff with it, and I just need to, like, I have other things I need to do, right? I got stuff I need to build every day.
You need to be productive, right? Yeah, I was watching, you don't watch Twitter. You look at Twitter. I was looking at Twitter earlier, and Zach Holman of Early GitHub, he was just tweeting about this new thing, and I noticed that someone responded to him. He was tweeting about this new thing that he's working on, and someone responded like, hey, have you checked out Go? Have you checked out Elixir? You know, a lot of people I know are jumping to Node. Why are you, you know, like, what's your thought process behind, you know, sticking with Ruby for this project? And Zach responded with, you know, I looked at a lot of other stuff and it's all intriguing, you know, it's all pretty cool, but I'm just really inspired right now and Ruby is what I know really well. So I'm just going to use it. I'm going to go with the momentum that I have.
Yeah. Yeah. It's for me with all these tools like Elixir, Phoenix, all this kind of stuff, I look at it, I read the docs and I'm like, this is really awesome. And it seems like I could probably write some really clean, nice code with this. But then I just look back at my schedule and it's like, I have a few months to make this business either profitable or at least interesting to an investor. So it's kind of just one of those things where it's always a balance, right? If you're really fast in something and it works, stick with it. I mean, this is a recurring theme for us, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, it's nice. Like, it's good to feel productive when I'm using Rails. At least I still feel productive, you know? I have that side project going and I'm using Elixir and I really do like it. I enjoy it quite a bit. But I'm obviously not near as productive as I would be in Rails, and that's fine because, you know, my day job is in a different situation. You know, I need to be productive. I need to be quick because we need to get stuff out the door. And if I weren't familiar with the technology I was using, obviously that just doesn't happen.
Right. I think it's really important to not go too far in either direction, because so often it's really easy to chase those new shiny tools. But at the same time, there is another group of developers who never change their tools, never reevaluate. Is this really working? Is this really still up to date? And, you know, am I able to do security best practices, which is a pretty important question. Even if you're still happy with a framework, if it's become dated, or a framework or a tool, but it's become dated and they're not doing security updates anymore, then that's probably a good time to reevaluate, for example.
Yeah, exactly. It all just comes down to, I guess, what you need to do at that moment, you know? That's kind of why, looking forward, why I picked Elixir for the Watch Nature stuff is because it was a good fit for the problem we wanted to solve. But also, I'm not necessarily in a hurry there. I don't have deadlines for that, which is very nice, but it also is very nice because then I don't feel pressure or stress to learn stuff. Maybe that's another reason why I'm enjoying it so much is because there's no pressure or there's no like deadlines looming that I think about when I'm working on it. So it just feels more like a fun thing than I need to churn this out sort of thing. To me, that makes a huge difference.
Right. It's always a balance what you want to be on the bleeding edge, because if you're building something out that is actually for like a large company or something like that, you're going to make different decisions. And unfortunately, a lot of the time, what you do tend to see is, especially early stage startups, making these calls where it's like, this seems like you kind of went for this because it's shiny, not because it was necessarily the right choice. And I think, like you said, because Watch Nature specifically is something where you don't have any hard deadlines and it's just something that you're kind of doing right now, mostly for fun, it's a perfect place to make that kind of call. Whereas if you've just gotten your first round and you're building out your MVP, maybe you don't want to go with the fanciest, latest thing. That being said, I'm the one using Nuxt right now on my, on my front end. So
I was going to ask about that when you said bleeding edge. How's that been going for you?
It's been a bit of a mixed bag. Overall, extremely, extremely positive. Kind of the biggest thing is basically my own fault for moving too fast and breaking too many things. The current version of Nuxt, as of the time we record this, does not actually automatically hash the output files in production. So, for example, you'll have your styles.css. Normally, with a Webpack build, you would do styles dot some random hash of the contents dot, not a random hash, the hash of the contents dot CSS. Mm-hmm. So that way, it's a cache buster, as I'm right. sure many of our listeners know. But unfortunately, the current version of Nuxt does not do that. So you always get the same file name output, which means that I'm having to like dump my CDN cache a lot and that sort of thing, and set my browser cache times really low.
Yeah.
Which is not the end of the world, but it's kind of annoying, and it's caused a few like incorrect, like accidental bug reports, basically.
Sure.
Even from myself. So I'm looking forward to that being fixed. That's not really Nuxt's fault or anything. It's no fault of the framework. That's just me not reading enough before I went ahead with things.
And that's coming out in the next version, right? I think I saw something on GitHub.
Yes.
That.
Yeah, I think it's currently 0.9.9, and it's 0.10 is coming out gotcha. Soon, and it's going to be in that version.
Yeah, I didn't even think about the CDN cache busting. It was funny because when you mentioned the hash thing to me, my first thought was like, oh, I mean, you're just going to have to hard refresh a lot more and tell, you know, the people that beta testing, like, hey, hard refresh. But that's a totally different thing if you're talking about, you know, serving through a CDN, because then you're going to have to actually manually dump that stuff, which is kind of a pain, right?
Well, in the Cloudflare dashboard, because I'm just using Cloudflare for this particular stuff, I can just go in and click the dump my entire cache button, and it's fine. It's not super hurting performance, but sometimes people will still have to hard refresh because their browser caches, and that can be difficult on mobile and blah, blah, right. blah. So it's just not an ideal situation right now.
Yeah, it's always good just to have the cache busting stuff there, you know, because I'm sure it's really frustrating to people, and it's one of the things I've said probably more in my developer life than anything else is like, have you cleared your cache or have you right. done a hard refresh lately? And people are always just kind of annoyed by that. They're like, oh, okay, yeah, it works now. And I think it's one of those things where it's kind of like little micro fractures in the foundation. So like someone, when they hire you, they have confidence that you can do your job. And when there's constantly little things like that, like if I'm constantly telling them, oh yeah, clear your cache again, I feel like that kind of affects that foundation a little bit. And I'm sure they're thinking about like, what about all the users that don't know that? What about the users that right. don't have direct access to you and things like that? So those little things, they add up. They, you know, it all adds up to the whole experience.
Yep. In our case, fortunately, we're still in early beta and it's a closed group of people. So it's not a major deal, and it's only when I deploy. So I'm just trying to batch up my deploys a little bit more. Really could be worse. Other than that though, Nuxt has been fantastic. It's been so good. In particular, doing stuff like pre-fetching data so that you can populate meta tags and all that.
Yeah.
Works just fantastic. Everything about it, I'm super, super impressed. And it seems like the two guys, I don't have their usernames in front of me, but the two guys that maintain it, I believe they're brothers, seem to be doing a super killer job, very active in keeping up with issues and marking things out. They actually have, they're using the GitHub projects for Nuxt. So you can actually go in and look at like what's on the roadmap and what's been completed and everything. It's super cool. Very well organized.
Yeah, no, they've been doing a killer job. I've been wanting to contribute to it for a little bit. I haven't had the chance to yet, but you know, the two projects that I'm working on that I've already started to implement it a little bit because it seems like the most feature complete way to do server-side rendering. And I know that's going to be an important thing going forward. But the fetch thing that you mentioned, I thought was really cool because I was reading the docs and I saw, I think it was under the API tab, they just had the fetch key. And maybe I sent you like a GIF of this earlier this week, but I thought it was just so cool. It's kind of dumb, but I thought it was so cool that I could refresh a page and all my data is there. And me knowing that there was an API request to get that data, but I look in the console and there's no API request. I know that the server did that. Obviously I know that, but I still thought it was just so cool that it's just working. You know, I didn't have to do anything really special besides use the fetch key and, you know, you reload the page hard and you just get data, you just get HTML and you click around and suddenly you're in a spot. It's so seamless. And again, like I said, it's kind of dumb because, yeah, I know exactly how it works, but for some reason, it just weirded me out when I looked in the console and I was like, wait a minute, there's no XHR right here.
Right. It's like, that's the entire point of Nuxt, but at the same time, it still feels sort of magical.
Because I didn't have to do crap. Like, there's this whole like hydration thing. Because when I first started looking at SSR, there's like, you have to have the whole server component. The server obviously has to be able to know where to get the data from. It actually has to make the requested API, get the data, render it, and serve it. And then there's a whole hydration phase. Then there's the whole like, okay, so once the app is started, once the app is rendered, you have to actually start up your application. You have to make sure that the data is in sync, and then you can finally go along. And with Nuxt, I didn't have to do that. It just kind of happened, which I thought was really cool.
Yeah, it's really awesome. I've done a bit of digging around in the source code, and there's some tricky stuff they're having to do to make that all work. It's pretty neat. I would recommend just clicking around in the source a little bit if you have time.
Yeah, I've been needing to do that. I haven't done it yet. Although today, I was talking to you earlier about that Ruby stuff. I was having some weird stuff happening with some Sentry things. I'm using Sentry for error tracking, as we had talked about. And so I was just kind of splunking through some Ruby code there, which was kind of nice. I'm trying to do that more instead of just going straight to the docs. And I'm trying to like also open up the source code at the same time. So I'm definitely going to have to do that. But one thing that I've been trying to focus on lately is I'm trying to approach, and I think I tried to explain this to you earlier this week as well, but I don't think I did a very good job, but I'm trying to like change how I approach building single page applications. And what's interesting for me is that I came into web development from a front end developer's perspective. And so when I was cutting my teeth, when I was creating all of my habits, the flow was you get a PSD and then you code a page and you get another PSD and you code that page. And, you know, the only similarity between them might be that you're sharing CSS. And then, you know, once you move into a CMS, you might be sharing partials or something like that. And for whatever reason, when I started building Spaz or I started using view components, I started creating very page-like view components. So if there's a page, I would have that page template in view. And if there was a second page, page B, I would have page B component and I would have that page in view. And that's fine. But as we both know, the more you do that, just the bigger your JavaScript gets. It just rolls into a snowball. And so what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to think about it more from an appy perspective is not really a good way to describe it, but I'm trying to approach it in less of a page by page template and more of a, okay, so this is an application. And one thing that started really hitting me was when I was looking through React stuff, there's lots of little like functional, like micro components. And I feel like they do a lot more with like passing functions as arguments for callbacks and things like that. And one thing that really clicked, was when you actually sent me your popover component is like the parent component, and then it takes a slot, and then each little list like menu item in the popover just takes a callback function. And for me, that like set a light bulb off in my head. I was like, I could do that way more, and I could simplify my code base, make it a lot smaller, and also make it more powerful at the same time.
Yeah, I've been super enjoying that popover so far. It's really nice. Basically, any menu across the site just is tied to this single popover component, and then each item, like Sean said, can take a function, or it can also take a path, and it'll just send you to that path when you click that via the router. And it's been pretty nice. I'm definitely trying to focus a lot more on making those reusable patterns. And a lot of that for me is sprung not even so much out of the programming side, but really out of just the user side of things, because I am having to do a lot of like UX thinking right now. It just seems to simplify things so much for the users as well, when it's that one thing that whenever they click this button, they're going to get something that functions in the same way and looks similar. That sounds, I guess, a little obvious and a little on the nose, but it's just something that I've been trying to focus on more lately. And I do think it is pretty helpful.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's probably, it becomes a little bit more complicated because then you're passing callback functions and things like that. But I guess to illustrate what I was saying before a little bit clearer is that if I was looking at different popover menus, I might make a component for like the user popover, and I might make a component for like a card. If you had a card and that card had some functions on it or some things, operations you could do, I might make like a card popover component. But in reality, then you have basically, you're trying to achieve the same thing, but you're doing it in two locations, and it's much harder to, so imagine that, but then you multiply it by five. So now you have like six different popover components, and there's a design change. Well, now you have to change it six places, and it's just harder to keep it reined in, you know? And I don't know why it set like the light bulb in my head when you showed me that, but I was like, oh, that makes total sense. And there's a lot of stuff I'm doing now I could actually simplify by rolling it into more of a dynamic component, I guess, instead of just kind of like keeping parity with whatever I saw in a PSD.
Right. Yeah. Anytime you're not making an actual page level component, something that I've been trying to ask myself recently is like, how many other components are going to use this component?
Right.
And if the answer is just one, then I am trying to rethink like if there's another way to approach the problem.
Yeah, no, that's a really good question to ask yourself. And that's, I think one thing that Nuxt really helped me with is how it kind of organizes the folder structure. So, you know, obviously most people aren't familiar. So you have your source directory, and then inside there's a pages folder, and that pages folder actually gets turned into a route definition. So when it builds the next project, it you know, looks at the tree, and then actually builds a route object based off of the tree in there. And so what I was doing before is I would have a folder called like posts or something, and then I have like a post page, then I would have, you know, several other components that a post page might use. But I find that splitting pages out into its own folder and then splitting out components into its own folder really encourages me put like container, like page container level things in the page controller, but other things in the components folder, to me, they feel more reusable now just because of where they're located, if that makes sense.
Sure. The other thing that's really nice about the page level components in Nuxt is that they actually get some additional functionality.
Right.
So like the fetch method that you can add only runs on page level components. And I do think that sort of distinction is kind of a nice thing just even conceptually.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that the distinctions there, like the small distinctions there, are what are helping me separate the two items in my head. And it's just small things, but maybe it's because I'm thinking about too much at one time when I approach things. I think I need to be better at, you know, because I have my famous Dropbox paper document that I just write big picture things in. But one thing I've been noticing you've been doing, like you sent me a screenshot of you using GitHub projects, and that thing is like down to a T. And mine are not. Mine are more like big picture things. And I think I need to be better at, before I jump into things, like mapping details out to a T. And I think that'll help me because then I don't have to think as much on the fly. I've already done the thinking up front, and I can just go and implement those ideas.
Yeah. Oh, man. I'm glad you mentioned the GitHub Projects stuff, because I'm loving GitHub Projects. It is great. It has made my workflow and like what I have on at any given point so much more clear to me. And to I think at least to an extent to the folks I'm working with. It's very nice. I can see exactly what's in dev, what I have scheduled up next, what things are blocked, why they're blocked. It's just great. It's great. I'm loving them. GitHub Projects, super well done. I was not sure about them at first, but really, really enjoying them now.
Yeah, I need to use them more. So what's interesting is when you talk about that, and one thing that I noticed, like the difference between you and me as programmers, is that when you're programming, you're not screwing around. you're super productive. And one thing that I noticed that what I do is sometimes when I'm programming, I'm not as organized, I don't think. I don't have as much planned up front. So that means I'm not as productive because I'm quote unquote programming, if that makes sense, right? I'm not necessarily doing something specific at that moment. I'm not focused in, I'm not lasered in on a thing that I'm doing at that moment, but I'm still working at the same time, if that makes sense. And I've noticed that when I'm in that state of like, I'm working, but I'm not necessarily focused in on one specific thing, I'm definitely not as productive.
Yeah. Having a very specific list of things to do is definitely something that helps me. And I still, like you say, I'm focused, and I can be, but I also tend to like get distracted by random bugs and fix them a lot,
right,
as well. And so kind of having this where I can see exactly the thing that I'm supposed to be on at any given point has been super helpful for me.
Yeah. And I think part of it too is just, you know, having so much to do, it's hard to make a choice on what to do. And I think another, you know, like organizing it and having it kind of put in a row, like having your ducks in a row, I think helps you deal with that decision paralysis, I've heard people call it. Maybe that's what I've been having lately. There's just so much for me to do on the front end and the back end and the DevOps end and all the other ends that it's hard to focus in on something. But no, I mean, I've used them a little bit and they've seemed to work pretty well. It's nice to like, you know, put like a roadmap project up and then pin it in Slack for my coworkers and be like, if you're wondering what I'm doing, here's what I'm doing, because they can see that stuff updated in real time. And I'm sure that's helpful for them. But yeah, one thing I did today is, and I know that you have some Slack stuff like Slack notifications going from your application, but I made an activity channel in Slack. And so I just mapped out a list of important things or things that I think that my coworkers would like to know when they happen. And those just get dumped from, I'm using the Slack notifier gem, and those just get dumped into that channel. For example, like when a new user signs up, when a sale is moved from pending to active. So like when a sale goes live, it'll dump a message into that. And when a sale expires, it'll dump a message into that. When a store joins, when a store is like onboarded, it'll dump a message into that. So those are really things, you know, like our sales guy, Scott, he can zero in on that, like a new user joined or like a store joined or something like that. He can reach out to them. And obviously, you know, down the road, we'll probably remove the sale notification because if things go well, it'll be blasting that channel.
That's the one you want to get annoying.
Right, yeah, exactly. Right. But no, it was like, it took me like 20 minutes. And I think my coworkers get such a big, it's just nice for them. I feel like they're more informed about things now. So I felt really good about that.
Yeah, we still have a couple Slack notifications in place, but I actually disabled most of ours because I finally got Mixpanel integrated. So all of our stuff is actually going into Mixpanel, and we have funnels and all that now. So you get much better data and it's less noisy. One that I did keep though is a 24-hour roll-up. So at, I think it's at midnight GMT every day, it kicks off a job where it just counts all of the business objects, like four different business objects that we want to track, how many were created during the last 24 hours. And that's been a nice one to see.
Yeah, I'll probably steal that. I'll definitely steal that. In fact, if I'm being honest to you, I'm pretty sure I have a tab open with that rake file already. Yeah, can't help it.
Great artists.
Yeah.
Thanks again to Rollbar for sponsoring today's episode of Does Not Compute. Instead of getting emailed every time there's an exception in production, relying on users to submit bug reports, or sifting through log files when you're trying to fix a problem, Rollbar gives you the context and insights you need to solve issues quickly. Check out rollbar.com/DNC to learn more. When you sign up using that link, Rollbar will give you 1 month of their Bootstrap plan for free. Learn more today at rollbar.com/DNC.